Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. And again, a blessed first day of Lent and blessings on your Lenten journey this year from all of us here at Catholic Answers. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and you've probably heard the phrase art for art's sake. It maybe is the most common slogan modern people have about art, but it wasn't always that way. There was a time when art was undertaken quite consciously for the sake of Christ and his church, following the disintegration brought on by the Reformation. Catholic artists, you might recognize some of the names, Michelangelo or Bernini, but many lesser known artists as well, were enlisted to help restore the wholeness of the church, to heal and to inspire with visions of wholeness and holiness. This hour, we reflect on their work and on the triumph of beauty and truth in Counter-Reformation art with Elizabeth Lev, whose new book, How Catholic Art Saved the Faith, is available now from Sophia Institute Press. Elizabeth Lev is an art historian, best-selling author, international speaker, and a certified sommelier. She teaches Baroque, Renaissance, and Christian art at Duquesne University in Rome. Elizabeth Lev, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us in the middle of the Roman night.
Oh, thank you.
First of all, congratulations on the book. It is just a beautiful book. That's Sophia Institute Press, I think, is known for making beautiful books. I always end up commenting on it when we have one of their authors on. But this is the most beautiful book I've ever seen them produce.
I was really amazed myself when I first picked it up. I couldn't get over how heavy it is.
That's the exact same reaction I had.
It's glossy and it's wonderful. They did such a wonderful job.
Yeah, I picked it up. I was like, was there a brick in here? But it's because they have these heavy, glossy pages, which is exactly what you should do if you're going to have pictures by Guido Reni and Caravaggio and all the others that you have in here. Again, congratulations on the book. But is this claim maybe a bit overdone that Catholic art saved the faith? Or is there a special role that art plays in preserving and transmitting the faith?
I'll tell you, when this title was first being bandied about, I was a little hesitant. I'm not very rah-rah in my writing. But actually, as I was writing this book, I began to feel more and more rah-rah and more convinced that really Catholic art had a huge role in helping to preserve the faith, teach the faith, hand on the faith, and most important, it helped to resolve the controversies that were going on around the faith. So let's think about it this way. It's 1550, the printing press has been invented. And you have millions, 150 million documents being circulated around Europe by mid-1550. So people are really inundated with information.
Yeah.
Most the Protestants have really mastered this medium. They're really good at it. And they write these very catchy clickbait titles. You're going to want to read the stuff they're writing because it's so polemical sounding. Is it really correct that the church just starts either publishing back equally polemical titles or more complicatedly, when you're trying to explain dogma, you have to be careful and precise. So it doesn't make kind of
reading. Right.
It doesn't do pamphlets well. But what does work is art. Art can transmit a message, catch your eye, make a statement, help you remember, remind you of things through color, line, drama, light, the way that it happened throughout the 16th and then 17th century.
So these artists, however, they're not all saintly people. So what do you make of that? These people are truly transmitting the faith in a way that nothing else can do it, and they are not saints themselves.
Well, I think really it was, first of all, it's an all hands on deck moment.
Okay.
But also the fact is that these artists have things that they can contribute. It's an age where, despite the fact that when you study art history, the 1600s, so the 16th century, it's basically accused of having tried strangled art, that the church just wanted to control art and tell everybody what to do and have everybody walk in lockstep. The mere fact that a man like Caravaggio with a criminal record, or even the first women to become professional painters and get hired for altarpieces in Rome, which is a man's town art-wise, if ever there was one in the 16th century, it's a sign that the church is really casting into the deep. If you have something to say, if you have an experience that you can turn into something transformative and redemptive, give it to us. Help us. And so I really think these people become these artists who are very, very troubled, like Caravaggio, who is clearly a very troubled artist. They become almost like beacons of how to kind of struggle towards faith or light in the case of Caravaggio, even though he may be still mired in darkness. I compare Caravaggio a lot to Mel Gibson in The Passion.
I was just thinking about that, about the person who's seems in many ways to be the tormented soul. But even today, people will look at Caravaggio and feel, there's something there that draws them because it doesn't look – it looks like struggle. It looks like somebody who knows the dark and violent side of life.
He knew the dark and violent side of life. He also knew the danger of pride. I think – something that I find very interesting about him is as he moves later on in life and he gets into trouble, he's killed a man, he's on the run. I think one of the things that's fascinating is his works of art begin to focus more and more on the humility of saints. So, for example, the very large altarpiece he painted for Malta, where you have the death of John the Baptist. Here he is, you know, the man we know is John the Baptist. He's already been killed. He's lying on the ground. And now the servant is coming to remove his head to put it on a platter. And he gets more and more interested in this problem of humility. As a matter of fact, his last painting, which is a self-portrait, it's a self-portrait of him. It's David and Goliath. And the beheaded face of Goliath, which is preferred towards the viewer by David, is the face of Caravaggio. And what's really interesting is that the sword that David is holding, it's been lost now, but we know it used to read Humiliter, which is not only the personal motto of St. Charles Borromeo, Archbishop of Milan when Caravaggio was born, but it also means humbly. So it's interesting. A man who understood humility was the key and yet couldn't do it. And that struggle that we feel in his art.
Elizabeth Lev is our guest. Her book is How Catholic Art Saved the Faith, The Triumph of Beauty and Truth in Counter-Reformation Art. If you'd like to talk with Elizabeth Lev, 888-318-7884 is the number, 888-318-7884. One of the things looking at this art, and I don't know if I'm going to get in trouble for saying that. I don't even know if you're allowed to say this anymore. I'm struck looking at these paintings that it's better than the art we have today. Is that illegal? Are you allowed to say that?
I say it every day. So.
Oh, okay. All right. It seems so judgmental to say it, but I mean, it's if you're a normal human being, you look at this and go, "My Lord, that is just of a magnitude different than what the art is today."
It is. I think the mere fact that when you look at an exhibition like we keep talking about Caravaggio, but when Caravaggio had a monographic show 9 years ago, so only works by Caravaggio, it was one of the biggest blockbusters in history. So here we are, all going to see the work of this Italian painter who died 400 years ago in questionable circumstances. And yet it's his work that creates lines around the block, which doesn't really happen today in modern art and certainly not in modern religious art. We really drifted away from the idea of telling stories that are understandable. I think that's a very big part of it. Every single painting in that book in one way or another either represents an idea that in a storytelling type fashion, a narrative fashion, or actually tells the story of something that happened in an engaging kind of way. So we've lost the capacity to tell stories in pictures.
I'll throw this out to you and then we have to take a break and then we will go to calls. Callers, thank you very much for your calls. Just hang on. We'll get to you. 888-318-7884. Looking at this art, one gets the sense of a level of mystery that is missing in modern art. And I wonder if I'm right to say modern art is in many ways an intellectual exercise and it's an exercise in critique of what came before rather than an exercise in making something that is itself immediately beautiful.
I think there at some point we have to kind of make a distinction between modern contemporary art that's working for the market and for the secular public. I mean, okay. There's also a huge difference in the consumer of art, right? Because the art that's produced in How Catholic Art Saved the Faith is art that's produced for pilgrims and for people that have some sort of religious desire. Whereas today, where the money goes, where the attention goes, where the critics go, is in an art that's obviously and very overtly secular. So our problem lies more in how does the world of religious contemporary art, how do we produce religious contemporary art in a milieu where the audience has already been trained to go to a more intellectual, abstract, sentiment-oriented, sensation driven type of art. So we find ourselves in very different circumstances. We don't call the shots anymore as the church once did. We're sort of running around behind the galleries, the superstars, the famous artists.
But it's serious business, though. If you're claiming, and I do not dispute the claim in any way, that this Catholic art of the Catholic Counter-Reformation is powerful in preserving and representing the faith so that it can be whole and healed again. It strikes me that we're in a very similar time now. It's a different kind of rejection of the faith, but we're in a time of rejection, and we better get better at art.
I would say so. I think it's a fascinating topic that occupies a lot of my attention, our modern day iconoclasm. I feel like we've entered into a kind of iconoclasm, which has happened in two other occasions in the church, once in the 8th century and once during the Counter-Reformation. And we've entered into a new kind of iconoclasm where, A, there's a complete distrust of beauty and that which is actually representative. And there's also a sort of looking down on something that is easier to understand or even more engaging or pretty as opposed to sensationalistic.
Elizabeth Lev is our guest. Her book, How Catholic Art Saved the Faith, The Triumph of Beauty and Truth in Counter-Reformation Art. I tell you what, if you even if you can't read, I'd get this book. The pictures the pictures themselves are worth it. If you can read, I think you'll like it even more. 888-31-TRUTH is our number. We'll get to your calls for Elizabeth Lev right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Your questions, Catholic Answers Live.
Morning Glory. It's Catholic from coast to coast.
Suffering is, instead of seeing it as a participation in Christ's passion in union with his redeeming sacrifice on the cross, we see it as, oh, we have to avoid pain, we have to avoid suffering. People need to think that it's not about avoiding suffering that we think is meaningless. It's about finding meaning in the suffering that's unavoidable.
Morning Glory. Talking about everything important to today's Catholic. Tomorrow morning, 7 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
St. Paul's street evangelization isn't like other evangelism you might have seen on the streets. We don't yell, and we don't force anyone to pay attention to us. Instead, St. Paul's street evangelization is committed to presenting a positive, passionately Catholic presence to a world hungry for truth. For more information, or to start a chapter of your own, go to www.streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com. It's time to do our part.
Elizabeth Lev is our guest. Beautiful new book, How Catholic Art Saved the Faith, from Sophia Institute Press. So we're talking art today. If you have questions in that vein, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. Let's start with Jacqueline in Portland, Oregon, listening on the great modern day Catholic radio there. Jacqueline, your question for Elizabeth Lev.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm curious why icons are so treasured when the depiction of their people's faces are so ugly. I can't get myself wrapped around any of them because I like to see people look like people.
So icons, okay. So those strike Jacqueline as ugly. What What do you make of that?
Okay, Jacqueline, I'm gonna tell you a secret along with all the other people who are listening, I'm afraid. I'm not really a huge fan of icons. My closest friends will tell you that we have all kinds of arguments when I throw my hands in the air. But I will say that ironically, as it just so happens, I'm working on a new writing project which requires me to go and start looking at icons and think, take them very seriously. And I would say something that it was a little bit, it goes to what we were talking about before. Icons are very clearly mapped out. They're very easy to understand. So everything that we find, perhaps you and I find, not aesthetically pleasing, small mouth, really big eyes, really weird oval faces, long fingers. Each one of those things has a meaning. And once you can understand that meaning, it becomes a way of teaching the faith and meditating on the faith, and almost like a prayer, like a rosary prayer. And so as much as I personally don't find them very aesthetically pleasing, I'm sort of thinking about spearheading a campaign that what we need is more icons, because people don't really have a habit of prayer. They don't have a habit of understanding Mary has big eyes because she sees everything. Her mouth is small because she doesn't say very much. Her fingers are long because she wants us to see her son. So in some ways, icons might actually be the next thing to help save the faith.
What do you think, Jacqueline?
Well, except their noses. They have trouble with noses.
It's not that I would contest the point. I don't know if they have trouble with noses, but as Elizabeth was saying, there's something else at work than mere than realism in an icon. Is that a fair way to say it?
I think so.
All right, Jacqueline, thanks very, very much. 888-31 Truth, our number here. You know something I'm thinking about while I'm looking at this art and this kind of. I think the word is sumptuous, the sumptuousness of this Counter-Reformation art. Is there any way in which artists were part of the problem with the Reformation, in that maybe they were part of the stuff that came before Martin Luther and John Calvin? I think everybody kind of knows, yeah, the Catholic Church got a little bit sensuous there. And were they part of the problem before, or am I wrong?
Yes, art actually, so let's put it this way. It's 1500, let's say 1520.
Okay.
You've had Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel ceiling. You've had Leonardo da Vinci's Last Supper. You have Raphael's School of Athens and the Disputation. Now what do you do? Right? You're an artist. So I'm going to make a, I'm going to do a, what do you do next? So these artists are very, very formally trained in the wake of, these are at this point, they're super trained. They know everything about color theory. They know about line. They know their technical work. They're very, very skilled artists. But for them to just keep repeating the same three things, so they start to play with the images, they elongate them, and they try to find these different ways of showing what they know, but doing things from a more complicated angle. So also a very sophisticated art-loving public will feel gratified looking at these works. Oh, I recognize that line. It was used in Michelangelo's this, that, or the other thing.
Really?
So it becomes a kind of insider art, very much in the know. And so it becomes, as a matter of fact, a kind of art for art's sake. And as a matter of fact, the most dangerous accusation that was ever leveled at Michelangelo was when he was accused of loving his art more than his subject. And I don't think that was true of Michelangelo, but you can get that sense with some of the other artists. And then following in that vein, I mean, just to draw this out a little bit further. If you're just trying to get a reaction out of people by making, you know, the leg of a figure abnormally long, or you're using colors that are basically neon and artificial, if you're trying to get a reaction out of people, what's the easiest way to get people's attention, right? What's the fastest way to make someone look twice? You start to use the sensuality. So you start to get stories. Like I often use this painting in my class because it's such a perfect example. It's a painting of a Susanna and the elders, and it doesn't really look like Susanna's trying to repel the elders. And she's sort of twined around the two of them. You're like, I thought I read in this story that Susanna refused the elders. I must have missed something in there. And so they really start playing very close to the wind. And here's the most interesting problem that the artists are causing. If the fundamental tenet of the Protestant Reformation is read the Bible yourself and interpret it yourself, right? Mm-hmm. If the artists are doing that too, if they're reading the Bible story and not saying, well, you know, in the ideal world it would have looked like this, or it probably looked like this, they instead are doing, oh, I want it to look like this, so I'm going to make it look like this, then they too are guilty of the same thing that the church is concerned is happening with the Protestant Reformation. I often think of it as J.J. Abramsing the stories. You know, J.J. Abrams takes the Star Trek movies and then makes a whole new Star Trek that has nothing to do with the original.
Yeah.
That's kind of how I feel about these artists. They just like, oh, that's nice, I'll just do it completely differently. So yes, art really gets called, the church has to make a decision whether it's going to continue to sponsor art. And the church decides to sponsor art, but it does lay down guidelines for artists that they must follow.
888-31-TRUTH, the number, Elizabeth Lev, our guest. And we go now to Renato in San Bernardino, Paraguay. Oh, I'm sorry I made you wait. I didn't realize the call came from Paraguay. Listening on the EWTN app. Renato, your question for Elizabeth Lev.
Hi, Sai, how are you? Good evening. And hi, Mrs. Elizabeth. Great pleasure to meet you. I see Sai still got some remnants of the ashes on his forehead from Ash Wednesday. So happy Ash Wednesday to both of you. My question has to do with mainly with the pictures of St. Joseph, because most of the pictures that I know of St. Joseph depict him as an older man, literally almost a grandfather-looking figure, which I do understand probably has to do with making people easier to believe that he was continent and keeping the virgin, virgin, of course. But then on the other hand, it also contradicts, you know, the call to chastity that is required of everybody. And so my question is, was the idea of painting St. Joseph as an older man the idea of a painter, or did the clergy have pass instructions to the painters as how they wanted the characters to be painted?
Oh, fair enough. So, yeah. So how do we end up with an older St. Joseph in the paintings?
It's actually a really interesting question. Joseph, so let's start with our – Joseph takes a very long time to show up in art. So the problem begins with this. They don't really show Joseph until 430 AD. His first appearance is in the Triumphal Arch in St. Mary Major in Mosaic. He's walking out of a house. He's wearing a short tunic with a little orange robe over his shoulder. He's represented as a younger man there. He's represented – he looks sort of like he'd belong in the imperial court. And then Joseph begins to make his first little forays into art. Joseph actually in art has many, many different looks. If you look at the works of, for example, of Murillo, when he does the Holy Family, he does a youthful St. Joseph. But in the Renaissance, they want to draw out, I think you're right, I think they do want to kind of emphasize the virginity of Mary. And they also want to draw out Joseph as the unlikely suitor. And so Joseph starts to look older. And sometimes, interestingly enough, he sort of begins to parallel with the kind of the white hair. He parallels that image of the father, of God the Father, who in the Renaissance really only shows up as a little face and a white beard in sort of the upper corner of the Annunciation. So he begins to parallel also the idea of the father and then Jesus's father on earth. And then the other reason why Joseph is often shown as old is because Joseph will then become the patron of the art of dying well. So then images will start to proliferate where we see the death of St. Joseph. So we see him as an old man because they want to draw out the idea that at Joseph's deathbed, he was accompanied by both his son, Jesus, and Mary. And so it's sort of the perfect death.
Renato, I'm sorry that Elizabeth didn't know very much about Joseph, but was that a... Does that help you? Does that...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the other half of the question was, was the where the painter instructed as to what the St. Joseph and the other figures had to look like.
Oh, yeah, fair enough. Okay, let's. We're sorry, we're up against time here, Renato. So
okay, let me just make this very quickly. The painters don't really make a lot of decisions themselves until you get to about 1300-1400. So the earlier depictions of Joseph are basically decided by a church tradition. Then about 1300-1400, we see painters beginning to think for themselves, but generally, or to interpret things themselves, but generally they keep to some kind of, there's usually a reason why they're doing it, which comes out of church tradition.
Renato, thanks very, very much for that call. 888-318-7884 is our number if you have a question about Catholic art, and particularly about how Catholic art saved the faith, because that is the title of Elizabeth Lev's brand new and very beautiful and not light book. It weighs, I don't know how many pounds. No, I don't know what the weight is, but you feel it in your hands when you pick it up. The subtitle is The Triumph of Beauty and Truth in Counter-Reformation Art. Again, your questions welcome. 888-318-7884. Right back with more right after this.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
The Catholic Church claims to be the religion in which the fullness of truth resides, but at times getting to the heart of any particular question of doctrine or morals can lead not only to personal confusion, but conflict and even disagreement among Catholics. In his new book, Teaching with Authority, Jimmy Akin sets the record straight. Teaching with Authority isn't about understanding specific teachings of the faith, but rather about understanding Catholic teaching itself. A unique, valuable, and long overdue resource for Catholics as well as those inquiring about the faith, Teaching with Authority will help deepen your understanding of what the Church teaches by showing you, maybe for the first time, how, why, and where it does. Get your copy of Teaching with Authority today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
In a culture that worships the pursuit of sexual pleasure, the Catholic Church's teaching on contraception can seem archaic and unintelligible. Its critics say it is outdated, theologically unfounded, and even harmful. And even faithful Catholics can have difficulty explaining this moral teaching. Catholic Answers is out to change all that. That's why we've just released Trent Horn's dynamic new DVD, The Case Against Contraception, using scripture, papal and magisterial teaching, natural law, and new insights provided by social science and medicine. Trent put forward a compelling case for Catholic teaching with his trademark charity and persuasive graciousness. Be prepared to give a defense. Order your copy of The Case Against Contraception today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging onto the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Have you ever sown seeds of discord in your life?
We're discussing the impacts on tomorrow's Take Two with Jerry and Debbie.
Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
What is wrong with my good friend Debbie Giorgiani? That's all I want. What is wrong with my good friend Debbie Giorgiani? She does those little tags and she treats me like I'm not her friend. My feelings are deeply hurt. 888-318-7884, the number here. We're talking art with Elizabeth Lev, who I have to tell you, I'm sorry that you couldn't get anybody good to blurb the book, like Bishop Robert Barron and Peggy Noonan and Cardinal Dolan and Newt Gingrich. But I do think there's you're hitting something. There's a way in which your work on art is doing work that people really want done. It has a quality of recovery to it, but it also has a quality of giving us some direction, which we badly, badly need. So I don't know. That's the flattery part of the show. Sorry, I don't even know where.
Thank you. I know. I'm getting.
I felt like there was a question going to come, and then I realized there's no question at the end of this.
I'm just basking.
Yeah. Well, but go ahead and bask, because it's a crisis, really, of art. I mean, I don't mean in sacred art and also in secular art. It's a crisis because of maybe, I don't know, we just don't understand art anymore. So I think that's why you're being so highly valued, is you're giving us that understanding again. John in Atlanta is next, listening on The Quest, one of my favorite Catholic radio stations in the world, The Quest in Atlanta, Georgia. Your question, John, for Elizabeth Lev.
Good evening, and let me continue the flattery. Dr. Lev, I'm a huge, huge fan, and I have your book, the new book, here in my hand as we speak.
It's heavy, right?
It is. It's remarkably heavy for its size.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to getting into it. Dr. Lev, my question for you is in regards to Michelangelo. I have an art history minor. I studied in Florence. I've read several of books on Michelangelo, and it wasn't until Bishop Barron's Pivotal Players episode that talked about Michelangelo's profound faith that I was ever made aware that he even had such a thing as profound faith. And I understand, you know, my education was in a secular university, but that's something that I have to admit was pretty new to me. Can you talk a little bit about Michelangelo's faith, how we don't know about it, and perhaps what are some good resources to learn more about it?
So I double whammy secular art history training. I had University of Chicago undergrad and then University of Bologna graduate, Bologna being, of course, the great communist city of Italy. Therefore, the idea of faith in Michelangelo was kept far apart in my studies. And it was something of a revelation to me to realize how much Michelangelo deeply cared about his faith and deeply cared about the issues of the faith of his day. He had a particularly strong Marian devotion, which now, after all these years, it's kind of like a duh. If his first work was a Pietà, duh. But he really, I mean, his devotion to Mary, which continues throughout his life, really shapes the way he views her, which is very, very unique. So that's first of all, one aspect of just understanding Michelangelo is just look at these images of Mary that are completely different from the way other people represent her. And you realize this is a man who has a very strong relationship with this woman. He doesn't just put her in the usual box that everybody else does. But I think more to your question. When you're asking your question, I had a little thought. There's a wonderful little story about Michelangelo. Because in the Protestant Reformation, many people believed that he was some sort of crypto-Protestant. I often tell people the oldest heresy about Michelangelo, that he was secretly a Protestant. But since today is Ash Wednesday for you and yesterday was Carnival, that's when the Seven Churches Walk was begun by St. Philip Neri. So St. Philip Neri, super counter-reformation saint, invents this idea of something to do on the eve of Ash Wednesday. Michelangelo actually went and did the Seven Churches Walk. This man was born in 1475. He does this walk when he's 75. He gets a special permission from the Pope in order to be able to ride a donkey because he's too old to do all the walking. And he also gets special permission to get an indulgence, not just for himself, but for somebody else. So that, to me, that's always a sign that he's totally with the program. He was also, just in case you weren't aware of this, a Third Order Franciscan. So he's actually buried in the Church of Santa Croce in a Franciscan's habit. So deeply, deeply, his faith marked his entire work.
John.
I did not know that he was a Third Order Franciscan. I've been to his tomb at Santa Croce, but I was completely unaware that he was a Franciscan. Are there any books or resources that get into his spirituality and faith, or is that something still to be written by you?
The pieces that I put together, they come from many different books. You could actually take a little bit of a look at some of his later poetry. The poetry in his later years really begins to talk about his state of his soul, his idea of his faith. It becomes much, much, much more evident in the final years.
Great. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, John. Thanks very, very much. Let us go to Malcolm in Washington State. Malcolm, you're next. Your question for Elizabeth Lev.
Hey, first off, that'll be an interesting read because there's big claims, of course, about Michelangelo being gay from the left nowadays. But anyway, I'm a little perplexed about the Counter-Reformation art kind of. I know you know, you've got Calvinist demolition, which was not true for of course, the Lutherans and all those other folk. So it's not like there was a necessarily imposition of sudden bad art. And guys like Michelangelo were borrowing heavily from the classical art you see in Rome and elsewhere. And just with all the movements in art over the century, I'm a little perplexed as far as how this, in a sense, saved, saved the faith. Even from a secular standpoint, you can tell I've got an art background. I mean, you look at the movements of art over the years, and you know, talk about shows lined up around the block. Look at the National Gallery and the Van Gogh show, and Van Gogh is no classicist by any means. But you know, you go through the eras of the great Romanticists. You know, even when you get into Dadaism, there's popularity in that. That's more modern, of course, but art has been so flexible and still so popular in so many different forms over the centuries. I'm just having a hard time pinning down how this is some sort of special revolution. That
so, Elizabeth Lev, how dare you say Counter-Reformation art saved the faith?
There's so basically, let's just throw in your little Van Gogh. Van Gogh's art, and what makes him so fascinating is his intense struggle with faith. If you delve into his life, you'll find his entire life is really fighting the question of trying to reject his faith. So even though he's not a Catholic, that's part of what resonates in his work. But more to the point, art. In the period of the Counter-Reformation, there was a need to transmit the truth of the tradition of the faith, the fundamental tenets of the faith, and to persuade people that the faith is something valuable. And so visual arts are a very effective means of doing so. We are convinced of things through movies and television. People have been convinced of all kinds of sociological ideas thanks to TV shows that they watch or series that they fall in love with. So yes, art can actually influence people, teach them, and change their minds. So the Counter-Reformation art, which marshaled the strength of color, line, narrative, storytelling, genius of these people to focus it on teaching clearly, beautifully, attractively presenting the tenets of the faith, the presence of the saints. It is actually a way of helping people who have lost a sense of a tangibility. They're filled with faith choices. Think about what happens in 1500. All of a sudden you find yourself with a bazillion choices. There's a new religion starting every day, and it's hard to navigate which religion you're supposed to be focused on. And the Catholic Church paints a picture for you that says, this is Mary, this is Jesus, this has been around for 1500 years, this is where you want to be. So I think it's a very, very powerful thing. Insofar as your discussion regarding Michelangelo's use of ancient art, Michelangelo takes ancient art and he reuses it. He doesn't copy them. He really teaches ancient art to speak Christian. So it's not a question. Art is, of course, flexible, and because of its flexibility, art can continue to change and morph so it can talk to different generations, draw on past beauty to talk to contemporary issues. So I don't think art's flexibility is a weakness. It's a strength in the faith.
Malcolm, thanks very much. When you're talking there and making the description you're making, I am thinking in my mind, and you tell me if I'm off, what's striking me about what you're saying is, we have seen in our own lifetime television shows transform our understanding, for example, of marriage. And
yes.
And so and in a very short period of time, in a period yes. of, you know, a decade, two decades, an utter transformation of our – and so I appreciate the analogy because television maybe does for us now what these works of art did in their day.
I was exactly thinking of that particular question. How radically our understanding of marriage, specifically marriage, has changed because we watch television shows that sit in our living room, become part of our daily lives. The same way the painting in the chapel where you go to pray every day, because it wasn't just 1 hour a week, these churches. They're open here in this wonderful country, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., except for those that have siesta. You are in there. It's your refuge from the rain, from the cold. It's a place to stop. It's a place to collect. So these works of art became as familiar to you as these television characters have become to us. And so they become very persuasive. So, yes, it was exactly what I was thinking of.
Again, Malcolm, thank you very, very much for the call. Lots of calls to get to, so we better take a quick break, and then we will come back to those calls. I want to remind you again, we've got a free ebook for you. Go to Catholic Answers Facebook page, and you can download just by clicking on a little tile there, Making the Most of Lent, A Spiritual Companion. That's a free ebook. To walk with you through Lent on the Catholic Answers Facebook page right now.
We're glad you're with us. Stick around for more Catholic Answers Live.
Listeners to Catholic Radio, I think, benefit most, at least initially, from what I call remedial catechesis. What Catholic Radio does is it becomes an echo chamber for the teaching authority of the Catholic Church. And what we're doing is teaching many things which have been neglected over the last 40, 50 years. If you listen to Catholic Radio, you know what the Catholic Church teaches.
Al Cresta thinks Catholic Radio is important. So should you.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their Catholic values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We're talking art, as a matter of fact, Counter-Reformation, Catholic art, the triumph of beauty and truth in Counter-Reformation art is the subtitle of Elizabeth Lev's really, I'm going to go out and say, magnificent new book, How Catholic Art Saved the Faith. And you can tell by listening to her this hour that she knows her stuff, and she'll help you understand how to fit all this into the history of into salvation history and into the secular history of the world. I was mentioning to you at the break, much to my shame, I've never been to Roma, your home there, the Eternal City, the Caput Mundi. I know all the names for it, but I've never been there. Okay, so we're going to go on pilgrimage there in November. Of course, you know, there's the things that you're going to see that you just have to see there. But maybe you as an art historian can tell me what's something that maybe people don't know to visit, or an artist they don't know to be prepared to see when they come for Rome. You want to give me any suggestions? And I can't pay for this. This is going to have to be free advice from you.
Well, in my mind today, because today started as Ash Wednesday, one of the most wonderful traditions and most beautiful things we do in Rome is we go to Santa Sabina. It's the station church for Ash Wednesday. And this church sits on the top of the Aventine Hill. It's one of the most perfect Christian churches. It's built in 430, and it's the crystallization of a perfect Christian church. And in the front of that church, in wooden doors that date back to 430. On the highest door on the upper left-hand side is the earliest image of the crucifixion in the world. So, I mean, I just try to think of something. There are a million things in this city, but I was just there this morning, and I was just thinking about how incredibly beautiful that church. It's very simple. It doesn't have the accretions of all the beautiful stuff. It's very simple, elegant, and then it has this amazing image.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate that. Pretty soon I'm going to be a cultured person. If I just keep at it, pretty soon I'm going to be a cultured person. John.
We could do this once a week if you like.
Yeah, you think? I think it might take more than that. I think I might need a more intense program to become cultured. First of all, I want to get to John Portland. We're coming to you, but off air, Keith in Cheyenne, Wyoming, asked this and wasn't able to stay. He tells us his favorite artist is El Greco, and he wants to know what you think of El Greco. I think he wants approval.
First of all, if your favorite artist is El Greco, then great for you because you have been out there looking at art. He's not the first person who pops up.
Yeah.
His art is extremely edgy. So that shows a very interesting taste on your part. El Greco is a fascinating artist. He's one of the early artist who moves from what we call mannerist. So this is the very elongated, almost a little bit clever in his design. His use of color is very artificial, but at the same time, he tries very hard. He's doing these things to evoke very strong emotion. However, I personally, because I am such a huge Michelangelo fan, I'm still mad at El Greco because he showed up in Rome, and when people were talking about the nudity in The Last Judgment, El Greco said that if they wanted to scrape it off the wall, he could paint it again and paint it better. So I'm still a little irritated about that. But outside of that, he's a great guy.
Other than that, Mrs. Lincoln. Okay, fair enough. Really, if you think you can paint it better than Michelangelo, you you are not lacking in pride of life. John in Portland, Oregon, thanks for waiting. John's listening on Modern Day Radio. You just can't do better than Modern Day Radio. John, your question for Elizabeth Lev.
Yeah, you were talking earlier about how some of the art that is being seen today, religious art, has kind of been dumbed down compared to what it was 400, 500 years ago, that it's something that just kind of appeals to the masses. And I wondered if you kind of feel the same way when it comes to the lack of true sacred music that we're seeing in so many of our churches. You know, you have a 1,000-year canon of classical music written for the church, early choral polyphony, great pipe organ music, and so much of this is not being heard anymore, and I feel it's part of what makes us different from some of the other Protestant megachurches that are just a rock concert and a sermon, and that it actually draws us in. We, as a church, are the caretakers of great architecture, great art, and great music, and it seems like so much of that has been lost in only a few short decades.
You said it, Brother Elizabeth Lev.
So I'm sorry if I gave the impression that I think that art has been dumbed down and cheapened for the masses. I actually am concerned that art doesn't speak to the masses. My usual issue with art is that I feel that modern day art is so busy discussing some esoteric thing that nobody can understand that art has really kind of left behind the people it's supposed to be serving. So usually my argument with modern day, this is just an aside, I feel like I might have given the wrong impression there. But insofar as music is concerned, music was so important that music was dealt with before art by the church during the Counter-Reformation. There were similar problems happening in music as were happening with art, meaning that religious music was becoming exactly what you were saying. It was becoming pop songs, rock concerts. They were writing pieces of music that were supposed to be more fun for people, so they would, you know, enjoy going to Mass more, but they couldn't understand the words. They didn't care about the words. It wasn't a form of prayer. And so in 1555, Pierluigi Palestrina, which I'm sure you know, wrote the Missa Papa Marcelle for Pope Marcellus II, who was fortunately alive during those 30 days in order to be able to approve sacred music. And as a matter of fact, sacred music pulled out of the tailspin that art was falling into in the 16th century long before painting did. So yes, music is And of course, Pope Benedict XVI, who spoke so eloquently about the importance of music. I think in many ways when he spoke about how beauty wounds and how art opens this wound in us that allows the beautiful to get in, that allows truth to enter us, I think more than anything else, Pope Benedict XVI tended to be thinking about music because for him, that was, I think, the most beautiful art form. So absolutely.
John, your response.
Yeah, and I appreciate the historical context there, but am I understanding you correctly that we should actually be bringing back a lot of this great music that has been lost? I mean, it's so tragic that there are these great churches, even here in the Portland area, some of them have wonderful pipe organs, and they're just never used at all, yeah. Or we don't hear as much of the early choral polyphony and the chant as we should. Thankfully, our archbishop is bringing some of it back. But
is that Archbishop Sample? Is he your archbishop?
Yes.
He's the archbishop.
Yeah. Oh yes. You're in better road towards beauty than most others. Your archbishop, he's going to lead that charge.
With your permission, Elizabeth Lev, I will make two suggestions to John. One, find out about the Benedict the 16th Institute for sacred music and for divine worship. Archbishop Corleone started that in San Francisco, and they're doing magnificent things there. The other, composer I will just propose to you, Frank LaRocca, American composer doing magnificent church music. And I got to do an interview with him. So I got to do that big fan interview like I'm getting to do with Elizabeth Lev today. So you can find that on Catholic Answers Focus. Thanks very much for that. But I want to – you know, he puts me in the mind of a question I'd like to ask you, Liz. When I talked with Frank LaRocca, who has written just magnificent contemporary music for church, including the new Mass of the Americas, part of what he points out is you want to draw on these classical sources and not just be a pastiche of these classical sources, that we have to do it for our times. I wonder if that's a problem with church painting, for example. Now that you've had Michelangelo, now that you've had Caravaggio, how does a contemporary painter incorporate all the things that have happened since then and not just be an homage, not just be a pastiche of Caravaggio or Michelangelo?
I think it's Michelangelo himself, as we were saying earlier in one of the earlier questions, Michelangelo himself drew on ancient sources, because after the Greeks were done perfecting the human body, what do you do next? But Michelangelo found a way to take those beautiful bodies of the Greek sculptures and turn them into something that would speak to the Christian world. So part of what makes a masterpiece, as Kenneth Clark said many years ago, is when the artist draws on the past and then reinterprets it for the age that he's living in. The thing that's coming into my head right now, since we keep talking about West Coast examples, is, for example, the tapestries by John Nava in the Los Angeles Cathedral, it's an ancient art. Tapestry is an ancient art. It's been done a million times. On top of that, it's very limited art. But he, between the technique, the technology, and the idea he had, he picked up the ancient idea of the saints kind of processing, that he goes all the way back to like the Basilica of Sant Apollinare in Ravenna, but he did it with these new faces. He did it with this brilliant technique. So there has to be a better sense. I think one of the things that keeps coming back in this conversation is also the question of architecture. If you're making churches and you want to make decoration or music for churches, first you have to have an understanding of what the church is there to do. It makes it easier for the artist to understand how he complements what the architecture is to do, and it makes it easier for the composer to understand how he's supposed to fill that space.
I appreciate that, because I have, having seen those tapestries, as a matter of fact, we have a John Nava tapestry in our parish at a copy of, I don't know what it is, but it's a lovely thing. I see what you're saying. It is actually the most beautiful thing about that Los Angeles cathedral, and I'll leave that there. But okay, so there are people who are doing this, who are taking the classical techniques and traditions and applying new techniques and making this a contemporary re-expression of what's really beautiful for the church.
It feels like a lot of artists feel so frustrated that they've moved off into more abstraction and things that are these kind of playing around with medium. But really, you can tell stories in new ways.
Well, that'll be the next book then, maybe. You'll tell us all about all the contemporary people doing this beautiful stuff. The book, How Catholic Art Saved the Faith, The Triumph of Beauty and Truth in Counter-Reformation Art. The author is Elizabeth Lev, who has been our guest this hour. It has, for me, been a delight. Thank you very, very much for the opportunity.
Thank you very much.
Tomorrow will be open forum, 2 hours, but guess what? It's going to be an internet open forum. So all those internet questions that have come in and we haven't had a chance to answer them, we're going to answer them tomorrow. As a matter of fact, we are going to wear out the internet. Jimmy Akin will be our guest both hours. Thank you for joining us today. We'll see you tomorrow, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.